I'm Jen Stringer, and this is a talk on lecture capture, innovation or capitulation. Before we introduced ourselves, we wanted to find out a little bit about you. So how many of you guys are currently lecture capturing at your institution now? How many of you are thinking about lecture capturing or in plans for putting more lecture capture stations in? How many of you make the majority of your lectures available open to the public? The rest of you password protected or for your students only or your institution only, something like that? Okay. Yeah. Okay, that gives us a sense of who you are. Thank you very much. I'm Jen Stringer, Director of Educational Technology at the School of Medicine at Stanford. I'm going to be sort of the director here today with not a lot to say, but sort of coordinating the conversation. What we'd like this to be is a conversation sort of between the positives and the negatives. I'm not going to call it a debate this early in the morning because that would mean that we might actually get into fist cuffs or something like that, and I don't think that's going to be the case. But it is going to be exploring sort of the positives and the negatives of lecture capture and confronting some of the things that maybe you're hearing at your institution from your faculty or your students about what the positives or the negatives are. At my institution, we've been capturing for over 35 years. We capture about 1,000 hours of lecture every year, and we make it only available to our students. We've begun to push some of our things into the open content realm via iTunes U, but it still really is primarily for our internal institution. And the debate is long gone as to whether or not we will lecture capture, but how we lecture capture is still a point of conversation at our institution. So with that, I'm going to introduce Mara Hancock and Josh Barron and let them tell you a little bit about their context and where they're coming from.
Okay. So I'm Mara Hancock, and I'm the Director for Educational Technologies at UC Berkeley. We've been webcasting, or been involved in webcasting, since about 1995. It began as a research project out of the Berkeley Multimedia Research Center with one of our faculty. And about 6 years later, he decided he really didn't want to be in the service business. And we formed Educational Technology Services at that time, and we brought in the webcast program under that umbrella. Since then, we've been webcasting both courses as well as campus events. We do campus events such as regular programming. Our chancellors bear in mind. We have a lunch poems program. And also folks that come to campus like President Clinton, the Dalai Lama, Jane Goodall. So it really is about sort of presenting and sharing a lot of the learning activities that happen on our campus. We capture about 50 courses every semester. All of this content is freely available and open to the world. We have a local portal called webcast.berkeley, and we also deliver it to iTunes U and to YouTube. In 2007, we started thinking about what open lecture capture meant to us, and we were revisiting the architecture of our system, which was a homegrown system and pieced together and had become very clunky for us and really wasn't scalable. And so we started talking to many of our colleagues and talking to vendors, and at that point we decided to launch a project with the help of Hewlett Foundation and Mellon to build a community of practice around this. So we started something called the OpenCast Project. And we spent the next year bringing people together and forming listservs and wiki sites to help people across higher ed help each other and to learn more about whether or not there was a potential for us to have an open source project out of this. And the conclusion was there was indeed an opportunity to do this. And we are now in the midst of a project that we call OpenCast Matterhorn, which we consider underneath the umbrella of the OpenCast community. There are 13 institutions, about half in Europe and half in North America, that are working to build what we call a rich media capture and delivery system. And hopefully I'll be able to tie that in and inform you more about that as I move forward. In this discussion, it's probably pretty clear I'll be representing the true believer position, and I'll do my best to maintain that position throughout. But you know, we all have our skeptics, and sometimes we can't squelch them, but I will try.
Thank you for that segue. my name is Josh Barron. I'm the Director of Academic Technology and E-Learning at Marist College. I'm also currently serving as Chair of the Sakai Foundation Board, for those familiar with that project, and Mara's on the board as well. A little bit about Marist College, because you may not know as much about us as my colleagues here on the stage. We're a relatively small, mid-sized liberal arts institution in Poughkeepsie, New York, which is about 2 hours north of New York City, about 5,700 students, about 220 faculty members full-time, and about 400 part-time faculty members. We've transitioned over the last 10 years or so from a very traditional residential campus undergraduate kind of programs to a much more comprehensive school with now six master's degree programs that are fully online. And so we've moved into that distance learning space in a fairly significant way and have plans to grow that over the next decade as well. We currently do use a lot of different media in our online courses, as well as the supplement face-to-face video and audio and other kinds of content, although we are not doing lecture capture, particularly in the kind of classic sense. And so maybe I'll leave it at that, because you can probably now really guess which our positions are.
So the way this is going to work is I'm going to sort of set the stage, and I have a number of questions for my colleagues here on the stage. After we give them a chance to have a conversation about the question, we'll take a couple questions from the audience, just a couple, and then we'll move on to the next question. If we still have time at the end of the morning, before you head off, I should mention coffee break, which is down the hall and to the right, only after this session is over, then we'll go ahead and take questions at the end as well. So that's sort of the way this is set up. So we wanted to set the stage a little bit to understand why we're even asking the question. I mean, who cares? Some people capture lectures, some people don't. It works for your institution. Maybe you've decided it doesn't work for your institution. But as you start to look at the statistics of video use in general, and how video use is just sort of pervading what our students are doing regularly, you can see that this is a Pew study here, that video watching outranks almost all the other online activities that people are doing, whether it's a short 5-minute YouTube clip, whether it's embedding their own video into their Facebook page. Video watching online is becoming just a part of our students' normal everyday activities. And you know that when that happens, they begin to expect it in the educational setting as well. Another statistic that I found interesting in the ECAR study was 200,000 files on iTunes U that were educational files were available for free in September 2009. 200,000. So that gives you a sense of what's being made available to our people, our students, actually, and our faculty as well. This is a UW-Madison study, online learning study, that said, do students have a preference for courses that have any kind of online content at all? And you can see that, obviously, students prefer to have content online for their courses. So they're asking us for this. This is, again, the same question from UC Berkeley freshman in 2006. Would you like to be able to download a greater number of lectures? And overwhelmingly, they're saying yes. So regardless of whether we think it's a great pedagogic approach, whether we think it's our mission to make it available from our institution for the public as a greater good, students are asking for it. And so with that, I'm going to ask the first question, which are just generally, what are the benefits and challenges of lecture capture? And I'm going to ask Josh to go first.
You sure you don't want to answer that one? throughout this morning, you're going to hear me speak very positively, I think, in many cases about lecture capture, and in some cases, maybe not so much. But I think in this case, what I think we're seeing is students wanting different types of access to the same types of teaching and learning that they've had access to in the classroom. And so certainly from the perspective of giving students the option of supplementing their face-to-face lectures they're going to and having the ability to watch those lectures multiple times, review sections of those lectures that maybe they didn't get while they're in class, or maybe later on in the semester they want to review those things to get ready for exams they're taking. I think those are all wonderful, great uses of lecture capture, really see that as a benefit of lecture capture for the student. I think where, and we'll get to this a little bit more later on, so I won't comment too much on this, I see it as an automation process. I see it as taking the teaching and learning process and making it easier to access, maybe a little bit more efficient and productive for the teacher, because they're not having to necessarily review the content over and over again with students individually. But I don't know if automation is the same as innovation. So I think later on we'll talk a little bit more of, is it really an innovative pedagogical strategy in terms of using technology to provide that kind of materials to students outside of the regular classroom?
In regards to the benefits, there have been a number of studies, as well as at Berkeley, we've done over the past 3 years focus groups with our students, and these really line up in terms of their findings. You know, the issue of students and what is our student profile now? We have very few students who meet the traditional profile of coming straight out of high school and being solely dedicated to coming to class and scholarly activities every day. They often have to balance work. They often have to balance family. So the ability to balance their time and make critical decisions about that, sometimes rather spontaneously, based on illness or work or family, is an important one. The other area is using it as a study tool. Consistently, we've been told that this is really a supplement to what they do in the classroom, and it provides them with the ability to review the materials as necessary, especially when they may not understand exactly what a professor has said in class. They can go back and revisit it at home and play it and think about it and send email to their friends and say, what did you think about this point of where the professor was saying X? So it provides them with a study tool. They can also, at a place like Berkeley, and this is dependent on how you deploy it, they can go and view how other instructors have talked about similar concepts. And that's one of the benefits of being open. And we hear from students with learning disabilities that this really helps accommodate for them, where they can go into the classroom and they can really put everything else aside and focus on the professor and what the professor is saying in the slides. They don't have to worry about multitasking, and then they can come back and revisit this content. And if you're not a native speaker, or even if you're hard of hearing, the ability to go back, raise the volume, replay the lecture, it's very important. We've had students say that they actually will slow the lecture down when they have a speaker who's very fast talker, or they'll speed it up if they have somebody who's a very slow talker and they don't want to sit through that. So there are a lot of controls available in this environment that aren't available in the live environment. I think there's also value for the institution and the faculty. Depending on your mission of your university, most of us have some sort of public mission, and the ability to take this content and expose it. Again, I'm speaking to the open area, but this is something that's of value in terms of the really supporting the mission and value of your institution. But there's another side to that, which is that you can come back and look at that content and look at some of the best teaching practices and really expose those and use that as a teaching tool within your faculty development group. So I think I'll stop there and so we can move on.
Unless Josh wants to rebuttal anything that we've
said. Well, maybe on the last point you made in terms of teaching practice, I think that at Marist, we push our faculty members, and sometimes they push back, but we like to push them to do different types of instruction in the classroom than lecturing. And I think that when we put technology in the classroom that, in a sense, facilitates the status quo teaching styles that's been there for a long, long time, there are sometimes that leads to change, but sometimes it also promotes the status quo and makes them feel that they're doing something innovative because technology's there, but they may not actually be doing something innovative from a pedagogical instructional perspective.
Any sort of response before we move on? So, yes.
One of the criticisms of lecture capture is that it captures only a portion of what the lecture is, i.e. the presentation portion, and doesn't really capture what most students consider to be an essential portion, which is the social interaction. How would you respond to the criticism that says that lecture capture is simply extending an old, outmoded view of the lecture as being purely a presentation event as opposed to an interactive social event?
So I'm going to let Mara take that. And did everyone hear the question? Okay.
Okay. well, I think there are several issues there, and I'll try to hit on all those. One is that I think we're talking about lecture capture in a very narrow sense, often when we talk about it. We talk about it as purely automation, capture from start to finish, and have it in a play viewer. And I think we're limiting our options when we think about it in that way. We actually have a lot of opportunities to do new and interesting things, including social engagement around this media, that we haven't done as much to date. So what I want to encourage you all to do is think not so much about exactly what we've done today in lecture capture, which is kind of a straight linear line, which is this is what happens in the classroom and this is what you get. But to start thinking about this as classroom course content that we can expose in different ways, that we can provide interactive tools around for the students and for the faculty. Now, in terms of the lecture and the outmoded lecture, we have kind of some topics we're gonna touch on that later. And I guess one of the things I wanna say is that a technology problem or is that a teaching challenge? And we really can't address this solely as a technology problem. This is really a partnership between our faculty development teams, and the technologists. And if we're just seeing it as a technology solution, we're gonna continue to have the challenges that you raise.
There's another seat right up here if you want to come sit next to me. I'll just give a little quick anecdote because I've had an experience at Marist that I think illustrates what you're getting at. We have a faculty member in our School of Management who's pretty well-respected, well, very well-respected and well-known lecturer on SWOT analysis. She's asked to go and do this kind of famous lecture all the time. And when she was asked to teach her first online course on that subject matter, she her preference and what she wanted us to do is come in and basically video, tape her lecture and put that on as her online content. And so she invited myself and our media services person in to observe her lecture to just get an idea of what we might do in terms of capturing that. And one of the things I did during the about hour-long lecture was count how many times she asked her students questions in the classroom. And this is a small classroom. We don't have large lectures at Marist. And so it was about 48 questions in about 55 minutes. And it was a very dynamic kind of, what do you think, and putting students on the spot and that kind of stuff. And so after watching her, I kind of brought this up, that if we just videotaped her and students were just watching that in their online course, that they would lose all those great rich interactions that were taking place in her classroom. So her first reaction was, okay, yeah, that makes sense. And so she decided that what would work would to have it be videotaped in a TV studio with a live audience kind of format and to kind of simulate all this question and answering back and forth. But I still think that, that missed the point of if you're at home taking an online course and you're just watching this, you're watching interactions, but you're not really participating in them. So I'm just, agree. I think learning is centrally about social interactions, and when you remove that, you remove a critical component. Now, if you're getting those social interactions in the classroom, and all you're using the video for is to supplement that, then I think maybe, you know, the issue is different.
Yeah, I want to add that one of the things I didn't say in terms of the challenges in the initial one was this issue of context, that often the way that we're doing it is we're delivering these recordings outside of the context of the rest of the course, and the lecture is not the entire course. And so the more we can do to bring these lectures into the larger context of the course, the better off it will be for our students and the learners that are involved.
Oh, you know what I'm going to ask next, right? How many of you have heard at your institution, don't put a camera in my classroom because the students are not going to show up and I'm going to have 5 students in the front row or no students at all if it's an 8 o'clock or an 8:10 lecture like this one is? Mm-hmm. So this is from the ECAR study that literally just came out. A lot of really good information. I would encourage people to take a look at it if you haven't already. But this question was, I skip classes when materials from course lectures are available online. And the students were asked whether they strongly disagree, that's on the left-hand side, or strongly agree. So again, this is self-reporting, and this is self-reporting of their own sort of intent, perhaps. But over 65% of students say it does not affect their decision to come to lecture. Doesn't mean that they actually come to lecture, but that the availability of online materials does not affect their decision to come to lecture. So with that, I'm going to ask Mara first to address the issue of lecture attendance, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about what you've seen at your institution, if you've got information.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, ECAR, this is not alone. Other studies that are looking at the value of lecture capture also replicate that data. And our students at Berkeley also tell us that really this is supplemental material that and it does not impact their decision to attend class. I also want to just mention that we have a list of various articles on podcasting and its impact and pedagogy on our Opencast site, and we have a URL that we'll post a little bit later. So, you know, I think that I really understand that students do still like to attend lecture. In fact, I like to attend lecture in person if I can. But despite that personal preference, I wouldn't give up the opportunity to learn something new or to catch up on something that I missed through a video recording that I can come back and visit simply because I couldn't be there in the face-to-face environment. So I think that one of the areas that you know, we do tend to think about this as being an isolated kind of experience, and we have the power to make it a not so isolated experience. In fact, we've seen that at this EDUCAUSE, where we've been streaming a number of the lectures. They've been incredibly wonderful lectures, and we have thousands of viewers on the other side who are benefiting from not being here. They're not being here, but they're able to benefit from what's going on. Still, that's not to belittle the fact that it is the chief objection that we hear from the faculty who choose to opt out. And I think there's an educational issue involved. We need to work with them. We need to expose some of this data. And we need to really talk with them about ways that they can mitigate that, as well as really take a look at what their whole course design is. You know, I think through looking at, we have an opportunity to expose it through lecture capture, that there may be opportunities to redesign a course. There may be opportunities to work with maybe mediocre lecturers. Attendance is an issue whether or not you're lecture capturing in that environment. And we have an opportunity to build more tools around that content. So I think on the sort of extreme side, I have a tendency to sort of put that over there and say that's, you know, you're waving over here and you're trying to distract the conversation from being about what is the challenge about lecture in general. And I'm not sure if lecture recording is the challenge. I said that earlier. I think that we do have a challenge about the way that we design our courses, and we need to address that straight up.
You know, I don't think there's a lot for me to add on this particular point, except I think an observation, and it's clearly not the intent of this study to look at this, so it's maybe drawing an inference that's not too valid, but you know, I think one of the possibilities is that we're seeing students saying, I see value in the social interactions that I get when I go to that physical lecture, and that I don't get if I'm just watching the video of that lecture. So I think that that might be an interesting kind of thing we're observing here. And then the last thing I'll just say is that, you know, one thing that I think could be very powerful is to look at changing what happens in the physical classroom to be more focused on interactions and move the broadcasting of information, which is often what's happening in a lecture, to the video. So I think, you know, this might also be pointing to the fact, well, maybe we should not lecture at all in the classroom, maybe put that stuff online in some type of other format, and engage students in a much more interactive learning environment when they come physically into the classroom.
Before we move on from this topic, I'm going to share a little bit about some studies that we've done briefly. We've looked at attendance. We actually did a head count, and then we looked at video views online for our lectures. And I'll tell you what we found. Well-attended lectures were well-watched. Poorly attended lectures were not watched. So somehow, students were giving the information to each other. I have no idea whether it was through osmosis. But we kind of called it the, if you're bad, you're bad, you're bad, you're bad online, you're bad in lectures, students don't come. And so that was one of the pieces of information. It's really hard to share with your faculty, though, because I think that sometimes, you know, when they're out there and they're like two people in the lecture thinking, oh, well, thank God, at least the rest of them are watching it online, and then you kind of pull out the data and go, no, they didn't watch it online either. And that was just a trend. It wasn't all the time. Obviously, you know, the day before a three-day weekend, maybe nobody, you know, attends class or whatever. But that was an interesting piece for us. The other thing was we asked our students about what their behavior patterns were, what they considered themselves. So about 25% of our students considered themselves never attenders. As in, they never attended, it didn't matter whether it was online or whatever. They didn't attend class. They chose other ways to study the material. About 25% considered themselves always attenders, and about 50% considered themselves usual attenders. And in their mind, that was if it was a 5-day a week lecture, that was 3 to 4 times a week. When you start doing the math with the 25% that never attend, and the 50% that consider themselves good attenders but really aren't attending that much, your lecture attendance is about 50% most days, which can feel, I think, like a lot of students aren't coming to class a lot of the time to faculty. So that was just some information to share with you. I saw one question, and we'll take that. Over here.
Yeah, and there are two studies that I can think of that reflect that, and we do have the links to them up on the website, so we'll point you there.
I'll just, because, and I've only kind of reviewed, I think, one of them that was passed around before this session, and I would just say that in looking at those studies, I think it's important to look at what the learning outcomes are that they're measuring in those studies. And if it's, okay, students who have the access to the videos were able to, and I'm going to exaggerate this to make a point, memorize stuff a lot better and spit it back on the test a lot better, okay, we see better learning outcomes if they have the video, but is that really the learning outcome that we're trying to achieve in today's classrooms to prepare students for today's workplace? And I'm not so sure it is.
I think that that's a really good point, and I think there's also opportunity to think about some of the higher level learning activities that can be scaffolded by this kind of work. So if you think about synthesis or analysis, a lot of that kind of work and review and research happens online. The ability to bring those together into a common environment to provide a a mashup, if you will, of that supports your hypothesis, that shows your analysis and your reflection. Those can all be supported in online tools around this media. So I don't think it's an either or situation. It's just simply about how we approach it from a learning perspective.
The next question has been sort of danced around a bit, and I want to get to some very specifics. A few years ago, there was a lot of conversation about the dead lecture. The lecture as a medium was dead. What is it going to look like in, you know, with our next generation or net generation students? We were building flat flood classrooms. We were using audience polling. We were doing all kinds of things. And people were sort of saying that the lecture was moving away and that certainly you'd see the number of lectures go down. This slide here is just to give you a sense of what, as we were doing in our research, the ideas around what a lecture 1.0 would be, which is, I think, what most of us, what this is pretty much right now, to a lecture 1.5, where are many people moving, to a lecture 2.0. And a lecture 2.0 is the idea that it's sometimes called a meta-lecture, but that it is characterized by flexibility, accessibility, multiplicity, and interactivity. So with that, I'm going to ask Josh. Josh, is the lecture dead? And if so, what role is video capture playing in that, or what role might it play in the lecture 2.0?
I don't think the lecture's dead, but I wouldn't mind killing it off. But that's a very strong statement. I think this is a great trend to see. I'm someone who really sees things like constructivist learning theory as really showing us that students need to be engaged in constructing their own knowledge about the concepts that they're learning about to get a deep understanding of those concepts. And it's only through that deep understanding that I think they can engage in things like problem solving, critical thinking skills, and apply that knowledge into novel areas that are not necessarily part of the course that they're taking. And I think that that's a critical issue here in the United States and around the world for students going to today's workforce, where critical thinking, problem solving skills is what people need and is what people are hiring for, as well as collaboration skills, the ability to work in teams, diverse teams, and get big projects done and solve big problems, I think is another critical skill, which also is not generally, I think, achieved in the classic lecture today. So at least, my feeling today is that the lecture is still very much alive and vibrant, the lecture 1.0, that is. I see trends moving us down this spectrum towards the 2.0. But I think there's a question in my mind as to whether lecture capture, and it really is a sincere question, if lecture capture is helping us move down this road or is potentially hindering us down this road. And maybe I'll just end by, I think we'll actually get to this a little bit later, so I won't say too much about it, but faculty members, instructors need to take a first step with technology. And if lecture capturing is the first step that they take and that gets them to do something with technology in the classroom they're comfortable with, that then leads to more innovative uses of that technology, I think then the lecture capture is a good thing and could be moving us down this spectrum. But if they do the lecture capture and think that that's the innovative or think that that's an innovation in terms of their teaching strategy and they don't go beyond that, then it could be, I think, a barrier to it.
I don't want to kill off the lecture. I love a good lecture. I mean, Jim Collins had me captivated. Larry Lessig, I wouldn't have wanted to have it delivered to me in any other way. I really enjoyed it. Now, to say that there might have been a breakout group to explore more of the topics, absolutely. But a good lecture is an amazing thing. Have any of you seen that Harvard ethics class that's being webcast? Now, is that not amazing? Now, of course, I would love to be a student in that audience, but I also really, really love watching that on video. So You know, I think that there is this demonizing of the lecture, and we approach it in a way that we often do in many of these areas. When we want change to happen, we become very religious about it, and we put things in their silos, and we say that's bad and this is good. But the lecture can be a very, very valuable tool for sharing information and knowledge and passion about something. So that's what I have to say about the lecture being dead. Now, on the other hand, I think lecture capture and technology can help us focus on some of the challenges that we face with lecture. I'm going to give you an example. We have a number of students at UC Berkeley who are non-chemistry majors, but their major requires them to go through Gateway course, Chem 1A. You're sitting in a lecture with 800 other students. You're sitting in the back, you see a little figure moving around. In fact, they're on a TV too, so you can see the professor. Now, there's very little interaction in that class, right? So in that case, well, I don't know about the value of the lecture, but if we capture that lecture, we change the experience. We actually make it much more engaging and interactive from a sort of metacognitive perspective. Right? So as a non-major, if I could choose to not go into that classroom, I could reallocate my time as I needed. I could then watch the video. I could stop it. I could start it. I could re-watch the experiments. I could zoom in on different areas. I could send chat messages to my TA. Now that, to me, would be a good use of video of lecture capture. So you really have to play it out based on the priorities of the individuals involved. But no, I don't think the lecture is dead. I think the lecture is a wonderful, vibrant thing that can be done really, really well when done right.
We're actually kind of friends, I think, right?
Yeah. So.
I guess the only thing I just want to add to that or comment on is, you know, I do draw a distinction between a performance and a lecture. I think some of the really engaging sessions that we've seen here at EDUCAUSE, I fall into more of a performance category, and that's a good thing. I mean, it's engaging. I found them very, very interesting and exciting. I got, you know, we were together watching it, and so I certainly agree that it's a powerful learning experience. But I think it's an isolated one, meaning that it's not something generally in a 15-week course, you're going to get, you know, that kind of engaging lecture every single time. And nor do I think that 15 weeks of that is really the right way of learning deep or getting a deep knowledge of content and theory. But it is very interesting and exciting and fun to watch.
Well, being cognizant of our time, we've got about 10 minutes left. I'm going to ask one final question, and then we're going to open it up to the audience. And my question is not on the questions that we went over, guys. So, oh no.
I didn't prepare.
But I was sitting here listening to you guys talk, and I was hearing that both of you are agreeing on the fact that making this content available in some way, at some point in time, is going to be useful. We're talking about zooming in on things, perhaps chunking up lectures so that students can gain more information in a different way, speeding them up, slowing them down. We didn't talk about searchability, but it's sort of, I'm sure, in everybody's mind. You make it searchable, it's easier for students to learn. And I think that's all well and great, but most of us who are lecture capturing aren't doing that yet. And so all the benefits that we're sort of talking about as a possibility and that I'm hearing that you might agree on aren't here yet. And so I wanted to ask Josh first and then Mara, what is it that it's going to take to get to that next step so that you might actually be on Mara's side, you know, in a couple of years, sitting and saying, oh my gosh, it's just like the best thing since sliced bread. And Mara, from your point of view, what is it going to take both technically, and I want a timeline from you, on when you think it's going to be that we're going to get to a point where everyone's going to say it was the best thing that we ever did, our students are learning more, and it's really moved us beyond the lecture 2.0 to something called the 3.0. So with that, Josh first.
That's a good question. you know, I guess I think we know how to do it today. Someone made the comment, or maybe Mara, you did, that the real issue is the faculty members or the instructors and the approach they take to teaching in the classroom today. And so I don't see this as a real technology problem as much as a teaching and learning, maybe professional development problem for faculty members. So it's a little hard to say exactly what technology would solve the problem. I do think that things like social networking technologies, the Web 2.0 technologies out there, provide us with outstanding tools to bring a lot more interactivity into this kind of lecture format, whether that's through online discussions that are taking place either in real time or asynchronously around what's happening or the content in a lecture, having students watch a video and then take from that and build from that in a wiki environment and create their own content around, you know, a seed that was planted from the lecture, I think could be very powerful as well. Maybe I'll just end with one example from Marist. We had a study abroad, we have a large study abroad program, and students in that program engaged in online courses at Marist at times. And we had, when podcasting was first coming out, we had our faculty members were doing a lot of podcasting to those students, basically podcasting their lectures out to those students. Students kind of really were not very engaged with that. And so we introduced a new concept called social podcasting. So the instructor would put out some information, sometimes it was audio, sometimes it was print materials or other media about a particular topic. The students who are in other parts of the world would go off and do audio interviews of people on the street, basically, about the subject matters they're learning in the classroom, obviously from different cultural perspectives because all around the world. Edit that content down to a few minutes, and then, you know, add it to one podcast, which became the social podcast, where they constructed, again, their own knowledge of what was happening in the class and applying it in the real world in their countries. I think that was a much richer use of this technology than we get with the lecture capture today. So some type of mashup there where we're trying to get students to get much more involved and much more interactive with each other and building their own knowledge around what's happening in the lecture, I think would be a step in the right direction at least.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that Jen asked me for a timeline, and I should turn around and ask you for a timeline, because I think it's really something that we're all doing together. The technology does exist in many different pockets, so it's an issue of how we allocate our resources and our time at this point. And I think from my perspective, what I've been interested in is the issue of really how we are able to scale that kind of activity so that it's not, you know, working with rich media can be incredibly labor intensive. And so one of the things that we're looking at in the OpenCast Matterhorn project, which is this build project, is the ability to build out a platform that is extensible, so many of you could all contribute modules to that. We'll have open services and things like that. But also that we're really focused on automating those things that aren't so sexy, that aren't so impactful on pedagogy, and then turning our focus to those things that are much more about engagement. So we have we basically break down the structure of the problem in four different ways. We think of it as the problem of capture and how we outfit our classrooms to do that in a affordable way. We think about it as the issue of how do we process this media and automate as much of that activity as possible, as well as getting important metadata and pulling data out of that so that you can have the discoverability side of that. And then how do we automate distribution? You know, we shouldn't be pushing up individually. We should be able to say, these are the three different platforms in which we share our content and have that done automatically. Then we can start to really think about what we call the engage side of the house. And that's about how we bring this content into the context of teaching and learning, not just in media players, but inside of our learning management systems, so that we can do some of the things that Josh really talked about. Now again, a lot of these tools do exist. They're much more manually focused. They may come at it from a different angle, but that's why we're really focused on building out this open source platform. form, looking at open and proprietary formats so that we can really mix and match these things, that we can bring the content into these different contexts without being trapped by sort of proprietary boundaries. So the timeline, you know, I would say in the next couple of years, we're going to start to really see this stuff take off. You know, a lot of the social networking companies are emerging around video to do more interesting things with it. They're interested in engaging in the Opencast project and community so that we can build in those integrations. So again, you know, Facebook, things like that, we can automatically push and pull content to, you know, across these boundaries, especially with the Web 2.0 world. So I think we should leave time for questions.
And she still didn't give me a date, but
I said over the next 2 years.
So with that, we've got about 3 minutes. I'll take a question or two over there in the back. And I just wanted to say, here are the URLs for both the Opencast project and all of the, we actually did do a lot of studying as we were pulling this together. And there are a lot of lecture capture articles that are on that lowest link right there. So with that, yes. Okay, so the question is there technology out there that can really capture the interactivity piece that we were talking about? Do either of you have any answers? And definitely,
no, I think you're really right. I mean, this is that marriage of the how we outfit the classroom and thinking about it beyond the concept of we just simply capture what's happening at the front of the class. I mean, there are classrooms that have microphones that, you know, hang in different places or have them on the desk, and there are ways of managing that. But you're right, it's an issue of cost. And so, you know, working with the hardware vendors as well as thinking about software is a really important aspect of this.
Good question.
Where do I fall on the Lessig line? Of revolution versus, well, I think that's a really good question, and you know it depends on your institutional appetite for risk in some ways and willingness to sort of push some of the real boundaries and questions. So at Berkeley, we've been lucky to have a general counsel that is willing to really take a hard look at some of this. We, as I said, we've been webcasting since 95, and we do a very light scrub over the content. We do have a post-production team that kind of goes over it, and if there's something that's extremely egregious, we will block it out. But we tend to be pretty light on that compared to something like MIT, which spends a lot of money on their scrubbing. But what we have on the other side is a very, very liberal takedown policy. So if anyone feels their IP has been violated or copyright's been violated, they can contact us and we will take it down and either we'll take the chunk out or we'll do something or we'll work out an agreement. We've never been asked to do that. So I don't know whether it is simply that we've been flying under the radar or that because we're a public institution and we're providing this public good that, and it actually from a business model perspective, it's probably good for them to have a small piece of content that's exposing their textbook or something else that we haven't been challenged. There's really, it's one of those things without going out and sort of waving a red flag, you don't really want to do that. So I don't know about that. Now coming from the other side with the faculty all sign off on IP agreement to make this open. We are under a Creative Commons license. The one area that they didn't feel comfortable with was the ability to remix or the commercial aspect. So it's a non-commercial attribution share, you know. That's a compromise, I feel. Like, ultimately, I'd like to get to a place where they would allow for remix and that kind of thing, but they're very concerned about their words being taken out of context. And so if you take that literally, you would say, then we can't do those kinds of mashups and learning. But then you add another layer of fair use, and then you can probably say, well, we probably could do that. So I think it's one of those ways where we step in to the problem and we start to raise awareness and then we have those good, deep conversations.
So we're at 9:01. Coffee's calling to you down the hall and around the corner. Thank you for joining us. We'll hang out here if you have more questions.